Hi, I'm DJ Peanuts. Keep me out of the studio. I'm a DIY DJ, and you can be one too. This is Listener Driven Radio, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
The following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives. Join us next week when the regular host will be back with a few new episodes of original programming.
And a good Friday morning, folks. And if it is Friday at 11 a.m. and you're listening to CKUW, you are listening to the Hope Alley of No Fixed Address show, the show that speaks for those that cannot speak for themselves, the homeless, the vulnerable, the those living in poverty. And we do our best, you know, to keep awareness on the front burners for these folks. It's a interesting day for the weather. It's 15 degrees, but you know, Debbie, we've had huge winds for about a week and a half now, and it's started out, well, yesterday with the winds were up to 90 k's an hour, and today they're gusting up to 40 or something. It says 33, but it was 40 or 50 earlier. Not pleasant. I mean, the temperature's okay, but if you're out there and you have to be out there and stay out there,
And the dust storm was bad.
And the dust, we actually had dust warnings for the first time in like 100 years, like dust warnings and wind warnings. And if you're living in a camp these days with the winds like this, you're afraid that your tent is going to be blown away. Just one of the small things that we don't even think about when think about, well, everyday life, and the homeless don't really come into our picture. So today, when you're going by Tim's, you're going by Rum's, you're going by Starbucks, as we say every single week, buy a second coffee if you can. Bring a water along. Actually, we're getting into the water dehydration thing these days because the temperatures are slowly creeping up. Look after folks out there. Be kind. Do what you can. And today we have a guest who is an advocate, like myself, Bob. Mario, are you there?
I am there. How are you today?
I'm good. This is not usually the way I do the show. I usually have a nice conversation with you beforehand and talk about things. What's your last name, Mario?
My last name's Bertrand. So Mario Bertrand.
Okay. You approached me about talking about the issues, and understand that you are an advocate at heart, and you are concerned for the folks out there that are struggling. Like I do on every single show, is I ask the guests to give me a brief bio, give me a bit of your history, and how you got to where you are today, and your thinking, and your heart, and your advocacy.
Well, absolutely. Again, I'm a pretty young advocate. I'm 22 years old, mm-hmm. but I've got a good lived experience when it comes to, the issues at hand, really, yes. in Winnipeg and Manitoba. I grew up in Habitat for Humanity housing, the French program that unfortunately doesn't exist anymore.
Mm. And, isn't that the way it goes, where government cuts in everything?
Right, exactly. And so that started really at my core, at who I am as a person, mm-hmm. the kind of supports that my family saw, and the fact that those are disappearing, or they're shrinking, or
yes.
waitlist is growing. And so across mostly my university career, I started realizing that this isn't just an issue in Winnipeg, because I had the privilege of studying in Ottawa, mm-hmm. and I saw that the issue wasn't just a trend in Prairie, Manitoba, or in Western Canada. It was across the entire country.
Yes.
And so I knew that this was something that we needed to start handling together on all levels of government, and with the community really first and last in line to the benefits mm-hmm. that really need to start happening right now. Mm-hmm. When it comes to housing, I did a bunch of research just to prepare not only for this episode, but I got to revise a bunch of papers that I wrote and
awesome.
Research that I did, and it was great.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about some of the thoughts you have and the papers that you have written. I know that we did text briefly, and you said your family, you did not grow up in wealthy environments, your family suffered through poverty, and you know, for me, I used to make over $200 a year, ended up on the streets for 30 months or thereabouts, and the worst thing for me was not necessarily the homeless aspect. Well, of course, the homeless aspect of not being able to get help for my mental illness from the hospitals and being rejected. But the worst thing was living in poverty after homelessness, and not being able to, like, on the street, I had no responsibility. You know, I looked after myself and I fed myself with beer can collections and drive through change and whatever else I could do to survive. But I had an instant caregiver role when I moved into housing. The first unit we were in was cheap enough, but the second we were paying 85% of our income to rent, and we could not survive without not paying rent. And so, you know, that particular time in my life was probably more harsher and more traumatic than homelessness was. Can you give me a little insight into how your family survived it and worked through it? Yeah, I have to have a strong mother to do this, or a strong father to do this and survive.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I really had a hardworking mom who worked 9 to 5 every day and found gig jobs and evening work and, mm-hmm. and things to keep busy, but also to bring a little bit more income into the home.
Right.
You can't avoid those coupon cutting.
You have to do those coupon cuttings.
Right. Yeah. But that's sort of normalizing thing that we're
yes.
seeing across Winnipeg as well. Right.
Mm.
A lot of families that are depending on these things, and if they didn't, grocery prices would probably see even higher than they already are.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, those basic things really started to pinch pennies, but it allowed the family to have, again, a little bit more stability. The roof over our heads was the step one, but it was a long path to go. And I can't imagine what you went through, but for every family, for every individual who receives those programs, it's a long path ahead.
It is.
And I was just listening to an interview that you got, and someone told you that one day you'd be able to do what you wanted to do, and it wouldn't be tomorrow, it wouldn't be the next day, but it would be one day very soon. And that sort of inspiring message is, I feel, exactly what a lot of families need to hear, and they need to feel that support along the way.
Yeah, that I'll never forget. And that was the doctor at St. Boniface Hospital when I was rejected by two other hospitals and leading to a jump off a bridge. And finally, I met a doctor at St. Boniface Hospital that I waited over 24 hours to see. But she saw through that homeless facade and that homeless person, she saw a person that was that was worth saving, and she saved my life and offered me those words and of hope, right? And and she understood, and that's a problem. So many people do not understand, but that doctor gave me the hope, the springboard of hope that I needed to carry on. And I'll never forget those words. They're embedded in my mind. And the whole problem is, our governments don't understand. During periods of time, our province would throw like $100 checks, $150 checks at people. Instead of solving the solution, playing the solution, they put band-aid solutions onto the folks that really, really need it, and it doesn't help. It helps on a one-time deal, but let's create situations that help people living in poverty. One good example, how our society is today, that since 2019, Harvest food banks have doubled in participation or users. Up the food banks, and that just says a lot about our time. And right now, things are even getting worse. And my heart bleeds for people who have trouble just getting by, because it affects your health and mental health and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, and especially food banks rely mostly on canned food, on frozen foods and things that aren't perishable, which is great for the long term and obviously financially for these food banks that have very thin, if not no margin.
Yes.
We really need to start connecting those with, I think, local farmers and local communities. So there's a little bit less of a barrier of entry, and the lineup in front of the food banks can start really decreasing. Those are the simple things that this government and a lot of governments across Canada can start taking those real steps.
Yes.
Everyone's struggling in this economy.
It's from
homelessness to the farmers, and we're seeing that in grocery prices.
And we are seeing farmers struggle with the oil crisis. It affects the potash, which affects the fertilizer prices and it costs the farmers more to plant seeds, and the seed prices go up as well. And it starts right at the very beginning, and it's just a tragedy how right now how things are going around in the world, and how what the President of the United States has done has created a crisis of poverty, and it's exacerbated it, and more people are drowning. Today we're seeing more people drop from middle class into poverty. And poverty into homelessness. It's just I can't explain how tragic it really, really is, the way our society is today.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you more. I really think that I think that the federal government is kind of taking an interesting and optimistic approach when it comes to the Build Canada Homes Plan.
I have a problem with that.
No, definitely. But it's the message there of we need to actually start building for Canadians by Canadians.
Yes.
And I think that approach is great, especially when it comes to sustainability. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a huge believer in modular housing. I think it's really the main way that we start building at pace, especially for the needs.
Yes.
But right now, Even with this program, it's still new. Like average cost, like monthly cost of living for a Winnipegger is $3,400 a month.
Yes.
Or $41,000 a year.
Yeah, and people don't even make that.
No. And then the average income, is $50,000 in Winnipeg or Manitoba.
Yeah, we are a second, a poor city when it comes to income here.
Yeah.
You know, the Build Canada thing is the new thing that that the federal government brought out. They don't have it in place. They don't have a real structure to it yet. But what it is doing, and because I've been on community advisory boards for Reaching Home, which is the phase of funding for the homelessness and housing that the government has had in place for about 10 years, it is being phased out, and the Reaching Home Fund, you know, we were able to fund the shelters to some extent. We were able to fund housing programs and housing first programs and put people in housing, but with the Build Canada, what it's doing is it's going to take away all of the lower echelon money, the money that we use, the house folks, is not going to come our way anymore. It's going to middle class housing. And they always said, this is a problem with the Liberals. I respect them for Trudeau was not a great prime minister in my books, but he's the only prime minister in the last, I don't know, 40 years that came up with a housing program, a housing plan, and did a lot actually for housing, and but the Build Canada is built around, you know, building middle class housing and expecting the trickle down effect and have more housing for those living in poverty and homelessness these days, but it never works that way.
I mean, that's a fair people there. I really think that I hope the program can keep expanding and they can start looking at this crisis in housing to be also a homelessness aspect, and that they can kind of return to the roots with what the initial program was, because I know that before the federal election, there was even a release of pre-made building designs for modular housing in different provinces, meeting the regulation standards. And I'm like, that's exactly the practical steps that governments can start taking to support everyone and to have a real vision to give people hope that, no, this is a plan. This is what we can do. This is what we can build.
Entirely. And I've run up against a different, you know, policy. In Winnipeg here, for example, they do not allow housing made from shipping containers, which is a most inexpensive way to build. You do have to consider the R factor, but it's still a lot cheaper than building regular housing. But they don't allow shipping containers to be used as housing here because for some reason that they'll fly off the foundation or something, right? I've had 100 shipping containers. I got rid of about 50 of them, 30 to the States and 22 different cities in Canada, but not Winnipeg.
That really tells you something, that the city needs to start keeping up with the issues at hand.
Oh, yes.
Zoning is only the first step. Like they just revised a bunch of zoning across the city to make sure that we can start densifying, which is a really good aspect to all of this, is that we can't keep growing outwards. We got to start growing upwards.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to start looking at creative solutions. And Winnipeg hosts a lot of leading ready-to-build homes.
Yes.
I look at but we're lacking modular. We really are.
We are too.
I think we've got the building techniques. I think we've got the know-how. Mm-hmm. And with the labor shortage that we're seeing in construction,
right,
we need to start thinking creatively. And if we want to start looking at homelessness, I know that a lot of people talk about tiny homes.
Yes.
I think that's one aspect for sure, and we got to still keep building in a way that makes sure that folks have a sense of community, a sense of belonging,
yes,
without throwing them into like these big homes.
I personally because I would have a difficult time living in a tiny home. I always say that I would never put anybody in a place that I would not be comfortable in. So, I, you know, sure, it's out of the elements and all that kind of thing, but it's just the final solution. I don't, you know, my opinion is that it isn't. I've been offered so many opportunities to work with people in tiny homes, but they usually have to be built outside the perimeter, which does not work well for folks that need supports. Or else built-in areas where supports are not available immediately, right? It's good to for minor transitional housing, and we need that too. But if we can build like a modular home or modular homes for people, that's the best. And you know,
modular apartments.
Modular apartments. In Vancouver. In Vancouver, they even have shipping container apartment blocks.
Absolutely.
And wonderful ones, you know. And we've even offered designs, design help for these things, and free design help for the shipping containers. But people are really reluctant to do this. But it's a really inexpensive way to build houses, especially in Vancouver where the weather isn't like it is here.
Mm-hmm.
And they use it, and they build wonderful homes. And I've been in several apartments, and they are almost luxury, which is kind of weird to say about a shipping container, but that's the way it works. But I appreciate that you've looked into all the modular models of housing, because we just don't have that here.
No. And thinking social and affordable housing is going to the lowest denomination of people that need it and the longest wait list.
Yes.
It's leaving a lot of stigma on the table and a lot of it in the community. And so it's an uphill battle to really start talking about homelessness and how we can actually start solving it, because it's an uncomfortable topic to have.
Oh, it really is. And, and we're still giving out corporate welfare. And a good example is, when True North built the True North Square, and this still bothers me. They've done a lot to make up for this, but they were given tax breaks if they put in 20% of low-income housing or rent geared to income housing in the True North Square downtown here. And they appealed it and begged off of it. They still got their big, huge tax breaks, but did not have to put 20, rent geared to income housing in. And, one of the owners of True North is the richest guy in Canada. Why are we supporting the richest people in the country when people are short on housing? I have to say, to True North's credit, they've done a lot of good in the city. They, at 190 Disraeli, when they turned that leather manufacturing place on 190 there into a shelter, they paid for all the renovations there. They paid rent for how many years now? And I think they eventually just bought it, but they've helped out the homeless community a lot, for the shelter. But it still doesn't make up for the fact that they did not live up to their obligation and house people in low income realm.
But that's not the only case that happens, right?
No, it happens all the time.
Right, exactly. Like, there's starting to be nicknames for this. That's how normalized this behavior is getting. Like rent evictions, when buildings start getting renovations and turn into these luxury apartments.
Yes, I have a really good example of that in our building. For example, they raised the rent 17% because they fixed the parking lot. We did the parking lot concrete, and then tried to actually get away with other things. When people moved out, they clean up the apartment, renovate it, and all that kind of stuff. But they tried to put that on the tenants as well. But there's so much corporate greed out there.
There really is. And we need to start looking at supporting co-ops and local housing initiatives, because these corporations are having more and more of a stake, and the government has less and less influence as to the housing market and making sure that those who need it the most are getting it. And unfortunately, that's just not happening.
No, I don't see how the federal government does not change. They're incapable of seeing that they need to start at the funding the bottom up. Former CEO of CMHC Canada, Rami, I can't remember her last name, but she came up with the plan to start funding housing from the bottom up. She only lasted a year, though. And that tells you a little bit about our political landscape, right? And she was the most down-to-earth, realistic CEO and person that I've ever met at CMHC or any other government agency. But she was let go. I mean, or only lasted a year, I think, due to frustration and not being able to move the system.
That's very fair. But I honestly wouldn't even look all the way at the federal government. I start looking, as we discussed, the municipal government and even the provincial government.
Yeah,
it is the provincial responsibility. And yet what we're seeing in numbers is a few hundred in the last few years, but thousands more are seeing their lives in the street.
I argue with that few hundred. This government blames the previous government, and previous government blames the previous government for municipal housing. Now, it's become, they've let it go. They let it become dilapidated. Take 185 Smith, for example. They had to sell it because they let it go. It was unlivable.
But, and they were unwilling to renovate.
No, and Essex, I think it was Essex, came in and fixed it up and spent $16 million on it and $16 million in renovating it, and now it's market housing. We lost 300 really, much-needed low-ranked income housing. Same thing as the Kapyong Barracks, and same thing as Mansub housing throughout the province. It's been let go, and we have hundreds of empty units that people can't even live in because they're not healthy. But folks, hang on, Miriam. We'll be right back. We'll have a quick music break and be back shortly. So hang in there.
joy and I'll protect you. Come whatever, call my name and I'll be right there with you. No one can tell you what is best for you. Truth be told, the right way often eludes me too. All you can do is put one foot in front of the other and keep on moving.
And we are back. That was Curtis Nowazak with Joey Landris and who was it, Debbie? I can't
remember.
Joanna Badoko. Debbie likes to put on local and support local musicians, and that's what we do on every single show. We are talking housing. We're talking advocacy. And being somewhat critical, I have to be, because I don't agree with much of what the province and the city does. I have friends in City Hall, and every once in a while, like, I'm on CGOB quite often. I have to say, well, I'm going to be on Hal's show today. You're not going to like what I have to say, but I always get, don't worry, but we need to hear your voice. We need to hear those controversial voices to keep us in check a little bit. But it's tough, you know. Every single move that the province and the city make when it comes to homeless and the shelters are wrong. And, you know, my good friend Cindy Gilroy, and she is a friend, and she's my city councilor. But, you know, she passed the motion at City Hall for the 10 areas of the city or 10 types of areas of the city where people can plant their camps, right? And it basically what it does is criminalize camps. But first, before we go on, I have to say you're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM, your community radio station right here at the University of Winnipeg, and you're listening to the Hope Alley of No Fixed Address Show with your host, Al. Now, and it's roughly 15 degrees with winds gusting up to 30 to 40. It's not comfortable. Yeah. Be kind. But back to our conversation, you know, how can you, you know, you give people nowhere to place their tents without, you know, being confiscated or fined? I'm not sure they come down up with the fines, but they have officers out there, policy enforcement officers out there, looking for tents that are in the places that the city says you can't camp. What is your opinion on this kind of thing?
I honestly think it's a band-aid solution, and it's going to increase cost to policing, which is already a pretty high cost for the city.
Well, it is.
Meanwhile, things like supporting heating and cooling centers and with community organizations, community centers, all that sort of stuff, that could honestly start working around the issues in the impacts that, like, why would we be policing these areas? Well, sometimes it's high risk of fire hazards. That's a huge one. And we saw quite a few buildings, unfortunately, burn down across Winnipeg because of these risks and because of more extreme weather conditions. Mm-hmm. So we need to start thinking proactively, and we need to start thinking smart with our money. And I think that really comes hard down to supporting those sorts of, again, heating and cooling. It's a tent with a little stove burner in it and someone supervising.
You know, I will say something about the camps. You know, like, I worked with the city on this stuff a long time, and somebody who should very much know better, who was a homeless indigenous individual years ago, who now has position. You know, we were talking about solutions for the camps in wintertime, and the, you know, generators came up, right? Which I think is a great idea. But some individual came up and says, well, you're just going to sniff the gas, so we can't do that. Like, what kind of idiotic thinking, what kind of small biased and discriminatory thinking is that?
I mean, not only that, but let's start thinking a little outside the box. You can lock the lid.
Yes.
Is that really
entirely, right? I just could not believe it came from an indigenous leader in the community who said that. It was like, it just blew me away. And, you know, stuff like that. And you know, with the province with their 30-day, Wild woke up in the morning and said, well, we're all going to go down to Houston. And they sent hundreds of people down to Houston, or maybe not hundreds, but lots, down to Houston to look at their model. And the problem is, Houston had millions and millions in COVID money, and they used that money to house people. Number two, Houston has a nearly 20% vacancy rate, 17% vacancy rate.
Wow.
We have less, around 1%, 1.2% right now, vacancy rate. We have a 0.05% vacancy rate for the low income or rent geared to income. Figure that one out, less than 1%. And so they go down to Houston, come back with, all right, we're all happy about, let's implant the, put in the Houston system. But it doesn't work here. We don't have the money they have. Now they have no more money either from the COVID. And so they're in basically the same situation as we do, except they still have a high vacancy rate, whereas we don't. And it's apples and oranges, and they spent millions just going down to Houston to learn about a model that won't work here. I do not understand that kind of thinking. But this is just the way this province works, and I'm so disappointed in this government. I mean, the PC government was horrible. Pallister had zero knowledge and empathy about people living on welfare or beneath the poverty line. But, I'm seeing a push to center-right by this government, and it's really discomforting.
It really is, and because I honestly think that this provincial government is a little bit more populist than we might want from our own government. Mm. It's leading to these big headline promises, but nothing leading to the door, and that's hurting a lot of folks.
No, that's it. Promises, where are they? And
yeah,
he's promised a lot, but nothing has transpired.
Well, the biggest one for me, especially on this topic, is the Your Way Home. It was this big promise to end chronic homelessness
yes.
by 2031.
And yes, he said within 8 years we'll get rid of homelessness in the province. Okay. And I said, what are you drinking? homelessness in this province or anywhere in the world will never end. Period. Never, never, never. Yeah. For every time you pull one person off the street, 1.5 people come back on. You will never end homelessness. We don't have the policy. We don't have the willpower or the political willpower to do it, and it will never get done.
Look, I believe in a little bit of hope. I think that we genuinely can one day. Again, it's that path. It's a long one, but we can definitely start taking it. And sure, the ratios that they're taking so far is people they house minus the people that go back onto the streets. That's a good ratio. But I think they invested over $100 million and are only, again, able to get a few hundred people off the street.
Yeah, and that few hundred people is an exaggerated number. I think their highest with the Way Home was around 92 or 93 or something. But then again, they also lost about 15%, which they're not admitting to either.
There you go. And so that tells you that there's no plan, there's no follow-through, and there's a lot of cost that's only increasing the stigma. And
yes,
the next time that the PCs come into power, because that's the cycle of governments here in Manitoba,
yes.
What's going to happen is that they're going to cut it,
yep.
And you're going to see even less results than before and an increasing number. And so this cycle is just going to keep continuing, so we need to start breaking that cycle.
Yeah, and what is the worst about it is the arrogance of this government. When they decided to close 190 Disraeli, they never consulted with any of the other shelter CEOs, executive directors. They only told Frank, who is the executive director at 190, or Nadinaway back. They gave him 10 days notice. And this immediately sprang fear into all the people that were in the shelter. And there are still 68, they replaced 190 with three other buildings on Maryland, on Webb Place, which is a really good building, and somewhere else, Wiedema, I think, on Logan. But there's still 60-some-odd folks who will not have shelter. And what kind of short-sightedness is it when the province does that? What kind of lack of empathy or, you know, sheer disregard for the homeless folks is it? And they say, oh, yeah, we'll look after everybody, but that's not true. And they haven't, and they won't, and they can't.
But yeah, back to that chronic homelessness thing. They were seeking to solve it, and we're over 4,400 people now in Winnipeg, and they're promised is 700 people by 2031.
No, that will never happen. I've been part of the homeless time count and the street census every year since it's happened, and you know, we've seen the trends, and the numbers that they came up with in the last street census was 2,200, but. The problem was the street census was skewed because they had 4 days of census instead of just one or two. And the last one, where the latest numbers are coming from, was a half a day. It was not a census, but a survey. And the federal government required a small sample. And so that's what they got. And maybe that 44 number came up, but is not indicative of what we have. Sure, I think the real number probably is 2,200 if you count the people, the hidden homeless, you know, couch surfing and staying with friends and all that kind of stuff. But it's vague, but the federal government needs some numbers to, you know, develop funds for this kind of thing.
And I honestly think that's where the census that hopefully will come out soon with some good results.
Yeah.
And we can start really looking at that with a critical lens. We're such policy nerds that I love to read the census.
Yeah.
It's something that I can't wait to
I spend many, many hours both as a neighborhood coordinator. I've been really proud to be the first, be part of it from day one, on the foundation of it, and ever since, and this year, and cleaning up the data is kind of tricky because it's very ambiguous. Some of the findings are really ambiguous, or the writing is very ambiguous by the survey takers. But it's a lot of fun working on this stuff, but tedious, a lot of tedious work.
Absolutely.
But it's I'm always happy to be part of the census because it's meaningful, and I get to, and one of the things I always talk about when I do my training is, like I send out, I always operate down the Main Street area, which is the largest basket or area, and I'll send out 100 and some odd volunteer surveyors, I see these university kids and other people coming back who've never, ever engaged with people experiencing homelessness, and they always say, yeah, it was such a wonderful experience, can we go back out again. And my question always is, and I'm happy that they're happy about it, but my question to them is, why are you surprised that they're such nice people? because there's an automatic assumption or presumption that homeless folks are dangerous and they're this and that. And I said, you know what? I spent 30 months out there. I would never hurt a soul, you know, when I ran away from any kind of trouble. Why do you think that homeless people are dangerous? And it's such a rewarding experience to be the coordinator and being able to send people out and get there. That's one of the byproducts that really matters. We bring awareness to people about who the homeless folks are, right?
Absolutely, and I think that's where schools need to start coming back into play here. The fact that students are kind of in this isolated bubble where they might start learning about Canadian values and issues, but they're not learning it practically, and that's hurting them and their perspective and long-term career and all of that sort of development. But it's also hurting the community at large. Schools are a tangential institution in the community, and yet they're kind of treated as a little bubble.
Yes.
Even university campuses are turning more and more inwards. They really need to start looking outwards.
And I train nursing students at U of M, both at Bannatyne campus and Fort Garry campus. And purpose is to bring awareness on poverty and homelessness and break down stigmas, right? How can you, my big basic question is, how can you give the best care? best health care to folks if you're carrying around your unconscious biases. And so many people do but don't realize it. And so, but we have such a great time, training the nursing students at U of M in all disciplines. And it's happy to say that, you know, you see the light get turned on. Halfway through the session, you'll see the lights getting turned on, right? And they'll get absolutely get it, which is really nice to see. But we need so much more education to folks to really understand what poverty is like. And it's such a huge cost, to the healthcare system.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that we're not, like, properly funding our homelessness, mental health, and addiction aspect of the healthcare is only feeding into this further. And more people are hitting the emergency room needing real psychiatric care. You waited 24 hours, right?
Yep.
And yet, now I think that number is probably double.
I think I weigh a total of like 62 hours altogether in emergency rooms during that period of time.
Right. and it's not gotten better. We know that.
We know that. And I know that because I sit on three WHA and Shared Health boards on reducing wait times in emergency rooms and task forces. And the solution is not there. It takes funding. And they just simply don't have the funds to add a lot to it. Sure, we get some additional funding to make some changes, but not enough. And, you know, we need a bucket full of money. But, of course, the healthcare system takes up, 75% of our provincial budget anyway?
But it does take a lot. But I think it's what we need to start looking at if we want to start breaking down these generational issues when it comes to families who are year after year and family after member.
It's generational.
Yeah, it really is, right? Yeah. And breaking through those income barriers is really huge. And the government really needs to start stepping in as more and more people are experiencing less money and real unaffordability.
Entirely.
Grocery prices, rent.
And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Everything. Exactly. Yeah. So we really need to start to, looking at real ways that we can start intervening.
Yes.
You mentioned Cindy Gilroy earlier, and I think I really love how she governs. It's very active. It's very in the community.
Yes, she is. She really is. Yes. And we are good friends. And I'm having a Walk for Lived Experience on June 6th. And if you care to come down, we're at Central Park. It's about a three-hour deal, but people come and walk two laps and leave after 15 minutes and just have a good chat with somebody. But Cindy always comes out and always supports, you know, my little walk with no media and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, Cindy's has a really good heart. I just feel that the motion that she brought making camps illegal in so many areas of the city is kind of wrong, but we have our disagreements.
Yeah, no, we disagree with as many as we can, but we try to come together.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
And I think what she's doing when it comes to even vacant lots is that other side of that coin where she's trying to increase penalties and she's looking to like take away titles for those who aren't paying their fair share.
Yes, right? And not developing those properties, right?
Exactly.
But Mario, we're kind of running out of time, but I appreciate you coming on. And you know, further to our earlier conversation on texting, I would love to have a copy with you soon. So let's connect after the show and set something up. Do you have any last words from your perspective?
Honestly, just keep building and keep having hope that we can really start having a future together with more people at home, less people on the streets, and hopefully a better future for everyone in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and across Canada.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Mario, and we'll get together later. And folks, we're coming to the end of our show, but I am holding my last lived experience walk around Central Park. I'm not getting any younger. I mean, I'm healthy as a horse, but I'm thinking, but it's a low-key event taking part on June 6th at Central Park for lived experience, bringing awareness. And my federal MP, Leah Gazan, always shows up, and ironically, I ran into her at Goodwill 2 days ago, and we had a nice little chat. And I just love her so much, and she's got a strong, she's a big fish in a little pond with the federal NDP, because I think they only have 5 seats now, which is horrible. But and we always, you know, Cindy Gilroy is always a big support, and I have other counselors come by, and people like Matthew Cutler, who's the CEO of United Way, is coming this year, and so is Jen Partridge from one of the big cheeses at Winnipeg Foundation, and Jamil. He's put up $200. He said, "I'll match any $200 donation that anybody gives." That's always Jamil, and he's always the first one there. He helps me go get the coffee from Tim's, and when I said I was doing it again on June 6th, he says, "I love this event," and because him and I get to spend probably 10 minutes before everybody else gets out, just chatting away about stuff.
Because, so the time of day.
Okay. Yeah, I forgot to put that on the flyer. I have to change that. But it goes from thank you, Debbie. It goes from 8:30 to 11:30, more or less. What happens is people come and go at different times because nobody has to come at 8:30. What happens is people come along and walk two or three laps, one lap, two laps, three laps, five laps, whatever they feel like, and. One of the good things about it is people get to chat with people they've never chatted before. And you see so many conversations going on between odd couples walking around the park, right? And that's heartwarming for me that we see people, you know, working or talking together to each other. But it's to bring awareness to lived experience and maybe a few funds for the lived experience circle. We've been on our own, you know, since the University of Winnipeg ran out of budget for us, and that happens in every sector. But the most important thing is that we come and just bring awareness to lived experience. There's no media. I mean, yeah, time there might be somebody, or my producer Debbie usually pops by, so I guess Debbie's media. And we might do an interview for this show. But other than that, it's low-key, and we have people from all walks of life in all areas of the city coming down. I think last year we had something like 15 altogether, which is a really good number. And at one point, I think 10 people were walking around Center Park. It was kind of cool to see. And it means a lot that people, you know, care about lived experience, and they come up for that reason. And again, we're still working on Symposium 3, which is May 14th, 13th and 14th, 13th evening, 14th day. We're still...
May or September?
Oh, sorry, September.
Yes.
Did I say May?
Yes.
September. And my speaker's lineup is still surprisingly the same, other than one or two. And that's really, really cool, because everybody wants to be part of it. Even Bernadette said, whatever you do, I'll support you. So that's kind of cool to come from the Minister of Housing and Addictions, even though we disagree a lot. But folks, come and see the end of our show. Come back next week. We're going to have Jen Black on, who one of my favorite people. She used to be with Leah Gazan, her right-hand person or something, and did a lot of communication stuff for her. She's now the coordinator for the Main Street Area Action Plan, and I work with her on that, and she's coming by next week. Something happened there. She's coming by next week to talk about the Main Street Area Action Plan. But I want to thank Mario for coming on air this week and having an intelligent conversation on housing and homelessness. But come back next week, folks, and you're going to love Jen Black. She's very talkative and quite opinionated when she allows herself to be. And so it's going to be a really good show, and I've been wanting to have her on for a long time. But, folks, it's the end of the show today, so when you're out there, it's a windy day. Again, be kind. Buy a cup of coffee or a steep tea. Donuts are only a buck at Tim's. Buy a donut. Give it away. You can afford to give away a donut for a buck. Anyway, take care, and see you all next week.